top of the table, that's exciting. Bottom of the table, that's exciting. Like, that's the sort of football that you want to be in. These are the pressure games that in 15, 20 years' time I will look back on and I will remember. These are the important matches for me, not the middle of the table teams.
Subscribe to the Koi Gig podcast stream on the OTB Sports app now.
Okay, it's time for us to turn our attention to this weekend's Super Bowl, which is taking place in Los Angeles. It's obviously the LA Rams against the Cincinnati Bengals. To help us preview the game, I'm delighted to welcome John Gonzalez to the show. John, this is the bit where ordinarily we go the ringers, John Gonzalez, but you've got a new job and a new title, and it's Senior Writer, Sports Illustrated, and host and executive producer of Sports Illustrated Weekly. So first off, congrats on the new gig.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. It's always good to be with you guys.
So the Sports Illustrated Weekly is a new podcast, long-form storytelling, and very interestingly, this week you've chosen to speak and write and broadcast about the city of LA and the impact of the stadium on the city. And that's a very interesting way for us to access a conversation around the Super Bowl and the impact that sport can have on society as well. So as a matter of interest, instead of doing the straight preview of the game, why decide to talk about SoFi Stadium and the impact it's had?
Yeah, I live in Los Angeles. I live not far from where the stadium is. I've been to the stadium many times. It's beautiful. If we're just talking about a fan experience, it's excellent. I mean, it's one of the best places I've ever seen a game. But I also, as I was going there the first time, the GPS had routed us through the neighborhood that butts up right against the stadium. And I wondered to myself, like, what would it be like? Because the stadium is gigantic. It's one of the biggest stadiums in the world, and I believe the most expensive. But it's in a proper neighborhood. So you're driving through, you know, houses, apartments, and then all of a sudden, here's this massive complex that just grows up out of this neighborhood. And I wondered to myself, you know, what would it be like if I lived here? Like right next to the stadium. I live, you know, not far from there, but I don't have that same influx of traffic and people coming into my neighborhood every single weekend for a football game. So that was sort of the impetus for it.
And what is it like? What? Because you spoke to a load of the residents and their experience is not a uniformly positive one, it's safe to say.
Yeah, that's correct. The mayor of Inglewood will tell you how greatly beneficial this stadium is for Inglewood, and certainly it has created growth in different business types. It's been a boon for the Rams. But if you are a resident of Inglewood, Inglewood is one of the poorer communities in Los Angeles County. It's predominantly Black, Hispanic, and Latino, and rent prices have exploded. They've skyrocketed in the last 5 years since the stadium was first started construction. Home prices have increased. People who have lived there for generations have been priced out of the neighborhood. On top of that, the traffic, which is always bad in Los Angeles, is notoriously bad in Inglewood on game days because the city's about 100,000 people, and you have 70,000 people coming in on a regular game day for football. And then for the Super Bowl, it'll be 100,000 people. So that'll effectively double the population of Inglewood on Super Bowl Sunday. So it's not a lot of fun for people of Inglewood who don't really get to reap the benefits of all of the things that go along with having a massive stadium of that size.
It's interesting you talk about the city when you're talking about Inglewood. I think for us here in Ireland, the actual kind of the notion of Los Angeles is actually a bunch of different smaller cities that all go up to create this absolutely gigantic teeming mass that is the city of LA. And that's why this kind of spaceship that got set down in the middle of an area is just very typical LA. It's like, oh, there's no room for this. It's kind of a little bit like the city. The city didn't, you know, there wasn't a natural place to build the city of LA, and they decided, well, we're going to do it anyway. Let's just get the water out and make the water go this direction, and then we're going to build this city even though it shouldn't really be here.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly right. I guess I should have explained that better, but you did a great job of it. Los Angeles County has 88, I believe, incorporated cities within it, right? There's the city of Los Angeles, but that's a small part of Los Angeles County. So there are all these other incorporated cities that make up greater Los Angeles that make it the biggest sprawling, most sprawling city in terms of square footage in the country. I think it's like, you know, 4,000 square miles. It's absurd. I mean, you could drive, I say all the time, you know, you could drive an hour and a half from Los Angeles to Los Angeles. Then you're still in the same place. So Inglewood just happens to be a neighborhood where there was land existing, where they had previously had a stadium where the Lakers played, the Los Angeles Kings, the hockey team played. And so they had catered to sports teams previously, and they thought, okay, we'll put our hands up. The city was struggling. Maybe this will help reinvigorate the city of Inglewood. And it certainly has in terms of balancing Inglewood's books. the city of Englewood is doing much better financially, but I think the residents have really paid the cost on that because they didn't have a vote on this either.
It's funny, Stan Kroenke in this part of the world is really only known as the owner of Arsenal, and it doesn't have an amazing track record of spending big compared with some of the rival teams who have pumped money in, even though he could pump money in if he wanted to. He did build a very nice stadium that replaced the old historic stadium, and the team have never actually quite been as good since they've moved from Highbury to the Emirates. But His desire to shift the team from St. Louis to Los Angeles really was a singular, nothing's going to stop me, I'm going to do this come what may. And it seemed like everything was going great with that until the city of St. Louis, it seems, now have a very strong case for suing. I don't know if they're suing him or if it's him and the NFL, but this stadium story, which was supposed to be, oh, we're going to make everybody happy and create loads of jobs and money, it's not quite like that, is it?
No, not really. I mean, it depends on who you ask, certainly. I mean, if you ask Stan Kroenke, it was a huge success, right? If you ask the mayor of Englewood, it was a huge success. If you ask the people of St. Louis, who were left with a stadium and no team after a broken agreement, I would say that they would think it's decidedly less successful. And certainly, as we outlined, the people of Englewood, who now have this new neighbor, that, again, they did not vote for this. I mean, most places, when the stadium was privately financed, you were talking about, you know, Stan Kroenke throwing money at different problems or not. Stan Kroenke privately financed a stadium here in Los Angeles, SoFi Stadium, that was over $5 billion. Okay, that part is to the good. But the people of Englewood didn't have a say on whether or not the stadium would come to their area. Most times when stadiums like this are built, what happens is it goes on a ballot initiative and the people get to vote on it. But because of a loophole in California state law, Englewood was allowed to just gather signatures. They gathered about 20,000 signatures in a city of about 100,000. So roughly 20% of the community had a say in it. But then that allowed the mayor of Englewood and city council to vote it up or down. And not surprisingly, they voted for it unanimously. And then presto, all of a sudden, if you're living in Englewood, you have a massive new stadium in your neighborhood and you have no say in it. So I think that's the real bummer here. If you live in Englewood, you didn't get to decide whether or not you wanted to have all of this inconvenience in your life in perpetuity.
The other thing, I guess, the obsession the NFL had with putting a team and or teams, it turns out, into Los Angeles was the size of the market, as we were talking about at the start here. But it hasn't automatically transpired that the two teams who have moved to Los Angeles have suddenly met with a fan base that is hardcore and dyed in the wool and really in love with either the Rams or the Chargers. Is there any sign of that changing?
I think it's... So the Rams had a history with Los Angeles previously, and then they go to St. Louis and then they come back. So they had some residual fan base left over. And I think that now that they're in the Super Bowl, certainly you'll see a lot of people around town wearing Rams gear. But even in the NFC Championship, you saw... I would say the stadium was half full of 49ers fans. I mean, it ends up being sort of a destination game for a lot of visiting fan bases because LA, you know, football is played during the winter. People in other cities where it's cold say, hey, let's go to Los Angeles. We'll see the new stadium. We'll see our team play the Rams or the Chargers. Won't this be a fun getaway for us? But it ends up being for the home team almost less of a home game, certainly for the Chargers. I mean, the Chargers, I can't remember the last time the Chargers played a game in Los Angeles since moving up here where their games weren't dominated by the team that they were playing, the fan base that they were playing. So it's much tougher for them, a little bit better for the Rams.
Yeah, I heard Justin Herbert speaking to the Around the NFL pod during the week, and he was saying, oh, it's definitely getting better this year. And obviously he's going to say that because, like, you know, that's his job to say that. But I'm not sure everybody was agreeing with him. And look, they have a genuine superstar, and it'll be easier enough to sell tickets and create momentum behind him. McVay's been doing that with the Rams for the last couple of years, so you would think that if they were to pull this off, then maybe that's going to be another injection in terms of that. One last LA related question. Is it a sports town? Because, like, it does kind of seem like the whole idea of LA is it's a concept and people either buy into it or they don't, and sport kind of seems a little bit of an add-on sometimes to that.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is that it's a city of transplants. I'm one of them. Part of it is that it is so sprawling and there's so many things to do. And part of it is that the weather is generally amazing and you can just go outside rather than sitting inside and watching sports. So I think all of those things are baked in. To your point about whether or not it's a sports town, it is very much, if you're talking about the Lakers, it is to a good amount if you're talking about the Dodgers. And then everything else is it depends. The answer is what's happening. How good is the team? Can we rally around it? I think that you'll see, again, a lot of people being very supportive of the Rams this weekend. But on the whole, it's really qualified.
Do the Lakers have a geographical fan base in the city? Or maybe I say the city, I mean actually the county. I don't know the proper language. But did they come from a particular area, and so therefore that's where everybody grows up, their fan supporters of that team? Or was it actually just everybody in LA because the Lakers were so iconic early and so important in the formation of the actual league being so big that everybody, the whole city, got behind them?
Yeah. Less geographical, much more success-based.
Right.
I think everybody loves a winner. Certainly in Los Angeles, they love superstars. They love star power of any kind, whether or not it's in TV or movies or, in this case, sports. And the Lakers were so good for so long. And, they had the Magic Johnson era, and then they had the Shaq and Kobe era, and now they have the LeBron James and Anthony Davis era. So they've always been set up really well on that front. And front-runner town, for sure, and the Lakers have always given them a reason to support them.
Everybody loves a good bandwagon, it turns out. No harm, yeah. I guess, from a sports media's perspective, that these bandwagons are interesting to people. The other big thing that's happened in the world of the NFL over the last while is the Brian Flores case. It's still bubbling along as a subplot while the build-up to the Super Bowl is happening. I'm interested in your perspective. Like, obviously, I might ask your opinion on the madness that's gone on in the NBA over the last while. Is the Brian Flores story going to disappear over the next while and then come back in the off-season? Or are people talking about that and the Super Bowl at the moment?
Yeah, and this is part of the reason why I love coming on with you guys, because we get to talk about stuff like this. I've talked about it with your colleague Joe quite a bit. I fear that it will go away eventually, because invariably we have, as Americans and as sports fans, a really short shelf life in terms of what we think about. And, all of a sudden it goes down the memory hole. But this is also one of those situations where Brian Flores has brought a lawsuit, not just against three NFL teams, the Broncos, the Dolphins, and the Giants, but against the NFL writ large. So as long as the lawsuit exists, it's going to be something that has to keep getting talked about. But I also wonder what it's going like what kind of actual change is going to happen. Brian Flores had said on ESPN that, if I fear that this might torpedo my career, but if I never coach again and actual change happens, it'll be worth it. And that's that last part that I hope he's right about, but I fear he won't be. The actual change part, we haven't seen any willingness by the NFL to change how it hires coaches. I mean, you have now just two black head coaches in a league of 32 teams in a league that's 70% black. I mean, that's hugely, hugely inequitable. And they know that. I mean, there's zero black owners, and they're the people who have created this system of inequality. So I really doubt that the people who created the system of inequality will then go and interrogate why it's broken.
At the same time, I think it's very difficult to ignore the language in the lawsuit in particular. That so the FT had a free to read piece today in this part of the world, which they sent out to their Telegram users today, and it included the line about the white owners sitting in their box looking down on their largely black employees, and that uses the plantation owner language. You can't forget that, like, you know, and the players are going to be asked about that when they return for training camp and what their impressions of that are going to be. So, like, it does feel like there's a line in the sand being drawn. It's even like what Kaepernick started reaches here, and this is all part of a continuum, but that doesn't stop, does it?
No, I hope not. But I think, you mentioned Colin Kaepernick. Colin Kaepernick was out here talking about these things, and then all of a sudden he couldn't get a job. He won't get a job. And the propaganda used against him was that he wasn't good enough anymore, which, of course, was absurd, and everybody knew it to be so. And now I wonder whether or not those same things will be applied to Brian Flores. And it needs to be more than just Colin Kaepernick and Brian Flores. It shouldn't fall all on them, nor should it fall just on, black coaches and players. There needs to be people of all races to stand up and say, this is, this needs to change. This is a broken system. Just the other day during NFL Media Week, Jim Trotter, who's a member of NFL Media, asked Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, about this, which I thought was incredibly courageous. It was really well phrased. It was excellent journalism on his part. And the commissioner really didn't have a good answer for it. He said, we need to do better, which of course they do. Everybody knows that you need to do better. But what are you going to do to make it better? What are you going to do to give fair hiring practice opportunities to candidates of color who have not been afforded them in the past? And so far, we haven't heard any good answers.
Yeah, I guess it's also going to be interesting to see that the Broncos are probably going to be sold in the next while, but there's still very little, if almost, there's certainly no black ownership. I think Shad Khan is the only person of color who owns an NFL team. So it's going to be very interesting to see if anything changes that, or if they even look for a little bit of diversity in the room making these decisions.
Yeah, that's a big thing, right? I mean, it's not just about ownership. Ownership, of course, is like the main issue. But then you get into the executive level. I believe that there are 6 black general managers, again, out of 32 teams, and again, out of a league that's 70% black. So when you're talking about the people who are doing the hiring, the real power in the room is almost exclusively white. And that is a massive issue, and it has been as long as the NFL has been around. And they have shown a reluctance to change that. And until they do, you know, we're going to still be talking about these issues, I fear, for quite some time.
Oh, I've no doubt it's not going to go anywhere, and rightfully so. And we should keep talking about it. Segue, and it's kind of an uncomfortable segue, just to the game and the glitz and the razzmatazz. I mean, it's interesting that the halftime act is, I think it's Dr. Dre, and you know, so it's going to be interesting to see if any of them make any statements at halftime, or if they risk making a political statement at halftime. Who knows? I haven't even heard anybody discussing that yet, but that could be interesting. The game itself, what do you think is going to happen in this game?
I'm excited for the game. I mean, here we are, and this is such a great point, right? We spent this entire conversation so far talking about all the things swirling around the NFL and nothing about the game. And that's exactly what's happening in the States right now. Nobody's really talking about the game because there are all these other issues around the NFL that are ancillary to the sport that have dominated it. And, you know, you mentioned the halftime show. I believe Dr. Dre said the other day that, or one of the guys who was part of the halftime show said that it needs to be more diversity beyond the halftime show. Like, it's great that they're doing this halftime show, but what about in the boardroom, in the front office, on the field? So all of that is right. But the game itself, I'm actually excited for this game. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. The Bengals haven't won a playoff game prior to this year in 31 years, and all of a sudden they're in the Super Bowl. Joe Burrow is really exciting. His young wide receivers are really exciting. And then you've got the Rams, who went all in and traded away Jared Goff and a bunch of draft picks because Les Snead decided he was going to place a heavy bet on Matt Stafford, and it paid off. So I think the game, when we finally get to it, will be great.
In fairness to Les Snead, he also placed a heavy bet on Von Miller, and he took the risk with Odell Beckham Jr. It just seems mad that nobody else wanted Odell Beckham Jr., that nobody else was willing to take the risk. Like, in any other sport, if somebody with that talent was available, there would have been a huge auction for him. I realize that he'd blotted his copybook twice, really. But, like, he's playing really, really well.
Yeah, and he's doing it in a spot where they really needed him to do it, because, you know, Robert Woods goes down and they say, oh, no, now, you know, Cooper Kupp is having an all-time great season, but who are we going to get to fill that void opposite him? And Odell Beckham is available, and as you mentioned, he's really talented, and there was those knocks against him about what kind of teammate he is in the locker room and whether or not you want him on your team, but he's acquitted himself extremely well. And then you mentioned Von Miller, and all credit to Les Snead, because where other people said, you know, you might be giving up too much, what about the future, he said, I don't care about the future. The Super Bowl's in LA, we're in this amazing stadium, we have an opportunity to win now, and certainly that has paid off for them.
Everybody should go and listen to your new podcast and read your long piece about the football. But before I let you go, you've got your 76ers cap on. So
I love it.
The wild trades that, like, I don't fully understand the exact size of what has happened, but it seems like every account I follow, even the football accounts, are like, oh my God, this is like one of the biggest trades that's ever happened, it feels like.
Yeah, the Sixers have a knack for doing that. Ben Simmons hadn't been playing all season, had decided that he didn't want to play for the Sixers anymore. He was done with them. And James Harden recently did something that James Harden has, you know, been known to do, which is that he didn't want to be where he was anymore. So he was going to give, I'd say less than full effort in order to force his way out. And so he's reunited with his former general manager in Philadelphia, and Daryl Morey. Ben Simmons gets what he wants, gets out of Philadelphia, goes to a situation that I think will be pretty good for him. This is one of those rare trades where I believe everybody wins. The players win, the teams win. I'm ecstatic. I can't wait to see James Harden next to Joel Embiid. All of a sudden, this is a really fun time, not just for the Eastern Conference, but for basketball in general, because the trade deadline was bananas yesterday, and I'm really excited to see how it shakes out.
So it's Harden and Millsap in exchange for Simmons, Seth Curry, Andre Drummond, and two first-round picks. That's quite the haul for both teams.
Yeah. I think, I mean, from the Sixers' perspective, you're not getting anything out of Ben Simmons because he just literally wasn't playing. So for them, it's kind of trading away Seth Curry and Andre Drummond and two draft picks in order to get James Harden. And on the flip side, James Harden didn't want to be there. You add some really useful pieces. You get some nice draft picks down the line that could be useful. And of course, Ben Simmons, I think, would be a good fit next to Kyrie and KD. He's a fantastic defender, a great passer. He's awesome in the open floor. He can switch 1 through 5 defensively. Again, I think it works out for both teams. I'm excited, though, to see what happens when the Nets play at the Sixers on March 10th and whether or not Ben Simmons will show up for that game. Because if so, I hope he has his earplugs in. It's not going to be a warm welcome.
You Philadelphians, you're so nice to people who've snubbed you in the past as a city.
Yeah, we'll throw our arms around him. It'll be great.
Yeah, exactly. I managed to see Carson Wentz play once in Philadelphia. It was towards the end. It was a very interesting experience, and they lost against Andrew Luck. It was like, they don't really like this guy. They've just decided they've turned on him, and they let him know very, very frequently in the middle of the game. It was a very interesting experience. One last thing I just wanted to bring up. I was looking back. It was 2017. Our Super Bowl preview was with Chris Wessling. He was good enough to answer our email and to come on the show. And immediately we got this flood of texts, and that's even 5 years ago, about people, or from people who were like thrilled that one of the around the NFLers had deigned to grace us with their presence. And of course he did. He was such a gentleman to come on the show. And it's just fated that the city that he lived in and made his celebrity and his name for all the work that he did is LA, but the team that he had fallen in love with and then fallen out of love with, the Bengals, end up in the Super Bowl this year. So I just wanted to mention that in passing before we go, because I know obviously for you guys it's a personal thing.
I'm so glad you brought this up. Chris, and when you mentioned the Around the NFL podcast earlier, that made me smile, because those guys, they're awesome at what they do, but they're also some of my best friends. And Chris was my first friend when I moved here to Los Angeles, the first person that I became buddies with. And we were friends immediately. And, you know, I really miss him, and a lot of people do. And I think like the Around the NFL podcast has such a huge reach. You know, they're obviously huge in Ireland, they're huge in England, and they're huge here in the States. And there's so many people who have reached out and said that they felt like they knew Chris because of listening to him on the podcast. And I was so lucky to actually know him and to call him my friend. And he was like family. And we had his wife, Lakeisha, and Dan Hansis, and Mark Sessler, and Greg Rosenthal, and my wife, Colleen Wolf, all on my podcast to remember Wes, because it's a year since his passing. And it really does feel like Chris made this happen, because Lakeisha, his wife, is a Rams fan. So their two teams are in the Super Bowl. We've been calling it the Wessling Bowl. And, you know, I wish Chris was here, but to see this game together, like those two teams play each other, it feels like he is.
Well, look, we'll keep an eye out for the butterflies on the day itself. John, great stuff. Congrats on the new gig, and everybody should tune into the podcast. Thanks a million.
Thank you so much for having me.